All right, so one of the central themes in your book is how Western leaders often downplay or ignore China's repressive policies. Can you elaborate on why Western leaders have been so reluctant to confront China's human rights records, particularly in the context of trade and economic relationships?
Well, in fact, my own personal experience in covering China as a newspaper correspondent in the 80s, the US and Western countries were downplaying human rights, not primarily for reasons of commercial interests, but for strategic interests. So at that time, the need for China's help or cooperation in dealing with the Soviet Union was so great that the United States was downplaying human rights for that reason. And it was not, and then it switched in the 90s after the end of the Cold War to a tremendous commercial interest in China as the world's last untapped market. And so, just at the time that the strategic interest in needing China against the Soviet Union had really run out, the commercial interest took off, and there was a new and entirely different, but intense constituency for relations with China, such that we needed to down that U.S. officials felt they needed to downplay human rights.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. There's strategic interests, particularly they served as a counterweight to the Soviet Union by befriending the Chinese, forming an alliance. And then there's a lot of commercial interests now. There's 1.4 billion people in China, and more than 25% constitutes the first world, middle class and above. So that's over 300 million people, nearly the size of the United States, that can potentially be consumers. But all right, let's go on to the next question. This has to do more with technology. Given the ongoing tensions between China and the United States, particularly around technology, what do you see the key differences in innovation culture between the two countries? How do they approach global tech leadership?
I'm not an expert on technology. I would say this, that on the one hand, the United States has a tremendous advantage based on its educational system in developing new technology and new uses of technology. On the other hand, China has universities that are turning out a tremendous volume of well-educated engineering and science students. So I would look to the United States to continue developing new products, but China is quite capable of developing quite a bit on its own.
Yeah, my understanding has been the Chinese haven't been very innovative. The last Nobel Prize winner has been more than 50 years ago, and a lot of their
Right.
technology, their base of technology, comes from theft of American technology.
Oh, for sure. For
Yeah,
sure.
and
That was one of the several mistakes in the agreement in under which the United States supported China's admission to the World Trade Organization. That it didn't address the questions of technology theft. It didn't address the serious question of whether companies going into China, setting up in China, would be required to transfer technology to China.
Yeah, the Americans thought that they always have an advantage because they could innovate. They may supply the Chinese with not the latest generation of technology, but China would acquire at least maybe a generation behind, or maybe a generation behind or two, and the United States would always be able to innovate and create and surpass the generation that they had given to the Chinese. And the reason they were okay with doing this is because they wanted that large share of a market, and there was a stipulation where, from an exchange for market share, they'd have to hand over technology. So yeah, so that's
I
often
mean,
been.
I worked in China at a very early stage in the 80s, and when I think back now to the arrogance of American companies that the Chinese were very primitive and couldn't do X, Y, and Z, the contrast to the reality of today is striking. I mean, I can remember when there was a McDonnell Douglas manufacturer in Shanghai, and they would come back laughing at the incompetence of the Chinese, and they would never fly in a Chinese plane, and so on.
I can see that. Yeah, the if you look at during the Cultural Revolution and the way they've improvised with creating technology, the technology that they created, no, if you look at the Y-10, the plane that was created in the 1980s, which was a copy of the DC-9, a McDonnell Douglas plane, but it was only able to go in the air for like 30 minutes, and it broke apart midair, and no Chinese leader would ever want to ride on a Chinese plane because they can't guarantee the safety in its construction. I
Yeah,
remember that.
we should note that even today, China is relying on Airbus and Boeing rather than becoming a global airplane manufacturer for now.
They're trying to create the C919. But they're only using 30% of their indigenous technologies, and nearly 70% of the plane is made with foreign technologies. All right, let's continue to move forward. How do you evaluate the effectiveness of U.S. policies towards China? What do you think the U.S. could be doing differently to address China's growing influence without escalating tensions?
Let me ask you on this. Do you mean this is on technology or in general?
In general.
I think that it took the United States far too long to recognize that China was becoming a mercantilist country capable of absolutely transforming international trade. Should have recognized that, a good 15 years before it did. It should have recognized the threat of technology theft much earlier than it did. I think that the general direction of policies of the last, let's say, 7 years or so has been in the right direction. I think that, and I do date that to the changes in direction of policy that began in the first Trump administration. But I also think that one of the most important aspects of dealing with China as it is today are very strong relationships and alliances between the United States and its allies in Europe and Asia. So I worry. I think that the Biden administration isn't credited enough for all it did to work together with Europe and Japan, South Korea, Australia, in dealing with China. I left out India, but that's a more complicated case. And I fear at this moment, with a new administration about to take office, that has a much more negative view of America's allies. I fear that strength may erode.
Do you think the Trump administration, the tariffs that is going to place, in some newspaper reports, they said that they were going to tax China up to 60%. Do you think that China has a sluggish economy today, a lot from the real estate market, from the trade war? Do you think if we stop on higher tariffs, that the country will weaken and there'll be more protests against and more fingers pointed at the government that may be able to facilitate change and liberalization of the political system?
I think what you've just given voice to is an optimistic view. I think that first of all, let me say that I support higher tariffs against China in particular. Returning to my earlier question, I do not support tariffs on Europe and other countries to the same extent. I do think China should be singled out, and the rationale is its impact on international trade and its own restrictive trade practices. Yes, I think the impact will be quite strong on China. When I tease that you had an optimistic view, yes, I think that that higher tariffs and on China and a sluggish economy will produce a reaction in China. But I don't think I think that that reaction, first of all, I think that the party's control of the country is such that I don't think we're going to see, sorry to say, I don't think we're going to see some democratic upsurge. I think that the security apparatus is so strong that it can stop any protest movement that gets moving before it gets very far. So what it would produce is something that I think we've seen already, which is strong reactions within the top levels of the party from those who are involved in the economy and finance. And I would point out, there was a debate about this before, the longtime China hand from Britain, Roger Garside, did a book called China Coup about 2 or 3 years ago. And he predicted before the last party congress that there would that the leadership led by some of the economic leaders, I think it was probably Li Keqiang, or I can't remember exactly who, were going to overthrow Xi Jinping. And what that left out was the power of the security apparatus. And we sit here in Washington, New York, and some very well educated and very well connected people come from China with ties to the leadership and suggest that there is unhappiness with Xi Jinping. And I'm sure that there is, but people take from that the idea that somehow Xi is going to be overthrown. And I just find that far-fetched.
So what do you think has to happen to create a political liberalization or a path towards democratization in China? How do you see that? How do you see with the current surveillance state, how do you see getting around that or possible dismantling of it or
I don't see anything happening in the next few years. I think it would take a prolonged democratic, I mean, excuse me, a prolonged economic downturn and tremendous public unhappiness that over a process of years might cause the people of the country to voice their unhappiness, not necessarily in the streets, but in a series of mini protests, refusal to go to work. It's not quite clear to me how it would happen because I'm afraid I'm very pessimistic it would.
I understand. Since the publication of the China Fantasy, have you seen any changes in how Western policymakers or the public view China? Do you think your book had any impact on these views?
I think that, I mean, at the time my book came out, which was 2007, 8, It was widely attacked in the United States by China Hans. And it took 10 years, I would say 8 to 10 years, for the book to s suddenly, not suddenly, but for people to recognize that the two main arguments of the book were on the money, were correct. The first, that trade and greater wealth and investment in China were not going to lead to a political liberalization. Really, in 2007 and 8, people still believed that. I can remember, this goes back a ways, but Mike Oxenberg, very smart China hand, writing that he thought that maybe that the Chinese Communist Party was going to go the way of Japan's Liberal Democratic Party, that it was going to, in a democratic way, win every election, the way the LDP always won every election. People really did believe that. It was all linked famously to Francis Fukuyama's ideas about the end of history. And it took about 10 years. The other prediction of the book, which gets less attention, but I think was as important, was in a chapter called Who's Integrating Who or Whom? And the belief of the 90s and the aughts was that, particularly through trade and the WTO, but in general, the United States was going to integrate China into the international system. And I raised the point that maybe China would be doing its own integrating and would help create the appeal and financial incentives of autocracy to other countries. And that has turned out to be true too. So coming back to your original question, do you want to add? I mean, what was the original question again?
If there has been any, has your book had any impact on the
Yeah,
public view?
I think it had zero impact for about 10 years, and then I think it had a lot of impact. And I can't tell you the number of people who served in government and the who came back around and said, you were right.
Yeah. So do you think China's, especially during COVID, its relationship to the World Health Organization and other international organizations, you think that's a product of its economic development and operating within the realm of rule guidance, within a set of rules and with and expectations that the international community has for it, that was acting within the realm of these international organizations? Or like the World Health Organization praised China during COVID, when all along the virus, if it came out of a virology lab, started in China.
I think China has made a tremendous effort, and with quite a bit of success, to be represented and, if not overrepresented, on international bodies, the WHO being one of them. And it does this by campaigning with a bunch of pressure on other countries who are members of these organizations, and their rewards as well. We saw this, this showed up on the sports pages with the Olympics. And I think that was at play with COVID, that the international organization wasn't particularly going on the science, it was going on the politics of China's power.
Yeah. Makes sense. And what type of pressure did it place on other members of the organization, having to do with trade and economics?
To start with, there's pressure on individual members, pressure being sometimes economic rewards, sometimes pressure on the country, trade pressure on the country involved. I'm not sure what else there is to say on
Yeah,
that.
no,
Oh,
I
wait,
understand.
again, the question, the original question, what was the pressure?
So based on, I
And
know.
the one other thing to add is that there is an intense anti-American campaign by the Chinese with these organizations. So if you go along with the Chinese argument is if you support the United States, it's because you're supporting the hegemon, and you really don't want to do that.
Okay. So when comparing China to other authoritarian regimes, particularly in the 20th century, do you think the Chinese Communist Party is more likely to survive without democratizing? What factors make China's situation unique compared to, say, the Soviet Union or other dictatorships that have undergone transitions? What makes China unique in that sense?
Very, very good question. And the first and most important answer is that China is economically integrated in the international system in a way that the Soviet Union certainly wasn't. So even with all of the sanctions that get put on, the occasional, I mean, the somewhat decoupling that has taken place in the last few years. Nevertheless, the United States itself still does huge amounts of trade with China, and that's just the United States. China has, I mean, the German economy became almost dependent upon sales to China. Japan has huge amounts of trade with China, so it makes it much more difficult to deal with a totalitarian China than it was to deal with a totalitarian Soviet Union.
Yeah, so China's integration into the market economy has really played an impact, unlike the Soviet Union. And interesting thing about the Soviet Union, the United States and the Soviet Union were in an arms race, and the Soviet Union couldn't compete consisting of because of its command economy, and people were starving. There was no food on the shelves, and the Strategic Defense Initiative initiated by Reagan really put great fear because it could render the Soviet Union's arsenal impotent. And it was ultimately Gorbachev who introduced perestroika and glasnost, which led to openness and reform in the Soviet Union. You think anything like that could happen in China? You think it can take an individual when there's a lot of disgruntled a stagnant economy or a poor or a struggling economy, somebody within the government who is going to be sympathetic to the Chinese people, and that would lead to greater liberalization?
In theory, yes. I mean, I do think that if there were some entirely new leader offering a Chinese version of glasnost and perestroika, yes, I think that would have a huge impact. But the follow-up to that is I can't tell you the amount of effort that the Chinese Communist Party has made to making sure there is will not be another Gorbachev. Not well, there will not be a Chinese Gorbachev. And it's funny on that. Having said that, You have to look over this past 30, 25 years at how China reacted to that. So, at the be you know, in the 90s and aughts, how do we prevent another Chinese Gorbachev? The answer was we're going to have a weak leader like Hu Jia, meaning Hu Jintao. We're going to have essentially a collective leadership. So there won't be a strong leader who could adopt glasnost or whatever. And then they did a 180 with Xi Jinping. So we're going to have a leader that we can be confident will never emerge in favor of glasnost and perestroika. And he will be so strong that we don't have to worry about it.
So how important is the development of a robust civil society, if that's even possible in China with the surveillance state put in place by Xi Jinping, to the process of democratization in China, despite the state efforts to control information and suppress dissident? Are there any signs of grassroots movement or alternative forms of civic engagement that could eventually lead to political reform?
Again, a lot of the theories of democratization that were developed in the 80s following the changes in South Korea, Taiwan, and Asia, and then certainly Eastern Europe at the time of the fall of the wall are based on the idea of development of a civil society. And we all recognize that, and so did Ch China and its security apparatus, which has taken great steps to prevent any government affiliated organizations from emerging with any kind of strength at all. That this is now we're talking people to people. The second part of this is online, where they have developed the surveillance tools to make sure that there will not be any online organized opposition to the regime. So they have developed the 21st century surveillance apparatus to prevent the emergence of civil society. Having said that, I would note one thing that there are still efforts out there by people in China to do this, sometimes with great impact. So China's COVID policies turned around after a bunch of kids in Shanghai started turning out on the streets to protest. And of course, that was merely the symbolic act for the fact that people across China were really unhappy. So I can't rule out, I can't say that acts of civil disobedience, or maybe we can call it evident civil unhappiness. I can't say that they don't exist, and that they I think they do and can have an impact.
And what about the intellectuals and Chinese scholars that come to the United States and understand the nature of democracy, which is very, very different than the Chinese narrative of America in decline and how Chinese socialism is on the rise and America is a declining hegemon and their system is better in technological development and they're going to have the world's largest economy and so on. Do you think those people who get a taste of what it's like in America are going to come back to China and somehow facilitate some type of change, or they're the future leaders of tomorrow, or going to work in important positions within the government or in the private sector, may have a different understanding and look for and have an impact on political liberalization?
The problem on that is that the Chinese sky that the spirit of nationalism seems to be so strong, including among Chinese intellectuals, that I think they arrive and decide, they still believe in the superiority of the Chinese system. And so I'm not sure that, and particularly with our particularly messy democracy of the current era, I'm not sure that they're bringing back some message of positive feelings towards American democracy. Now, let me just a little bit of history on this, of what a tremendous change this is. I can remember because I was covering, not from Beijing, but from Washington, the aftermath of the Tiananmen Square protests. And in those months afterwards, Chinese nationalism, as it was opposed to the party. I mean, you had this tremendous outpouring of feeling China is a great country, and this what's just happened is tragic. I believe this is both in China and certainly among Chinese students in the United States, to the extent that Chinese students for those 6 months or 8 months lobbied Congress to give them protection from having to return to China. And ironically, the argument at the time by the most those who favored good relationship and maintaining good relationships with the regime, the argument was we want these students to go back to China because they will be agents for democracy and change, having seen what's going on at American universities and in the United States. And it really only took about 2 or 3 years for in my sense of it, for Chinese nationalism to begin to work the other way. And that's when it took only about 2 or 3 years to get patriotic student organizations in the United States and so on. Really the sense of Chinese nationalism is such that I just don't see anytime soon Chinese returned intellectuals and students as an agent for change in democracy in China.
I got the 10-minute warning. I know they only allow for 40 minutes on Zoom. So I guess if we get cut off, just recopy or repaste the link into Zoom, and we'll resume the last 20 minutes again. So I know I don't know how much time is left, maybe 5 minutes. So if we get cut off, we'll just, if that doesn't work for any reason, I'll send out another Zoom meeting within the
Good.
next 5 minutes to with a new link, but it should work.
Yeah, not a problem.
So, what responsibilities do you think Western democracies have when it comes to advocating for de democratic values in China?
I think a very strong responsibility. Governments have ha each individual government has some kind of voice. Often greater than any individual voice, and I think that they need to speak up for democracy, to speak up for those who are imprisoned in
Xinjiang,
China, Xinjiang, and elsewhere. It's
Tibetans.
funny. I hate to sound like a an old guy here, but the power of the Xinjiang cause, extremely valid and justified and important as it is, has somehow dwarfed out for the moment, is blanking out what's happening in Tibet, which used to have greater. There was greater awareness of Tibet and little awareness of Xinjiang in the United States for years. Either way, and I would have, of course, include Hong Kong on this. I just think that it's in the interest of European, Asian democracies to speak out on behalf of freedom of speech, the right to dissent, the right to oppose.
Now, should the United States and Western countries sanction China for violations of human rights, or is just speaking out against it enough?
I think that in particular cases there's an argument for sanctions. Yes, I've always felt that.
Yeah, I know the Biden administration was big on that too, sanctioning particularly in Xinjiang, any products that were made in Xinjiang by those who oppressed
Right.
the Muslims in that region. They were no longer allowed to
Right.
export their products to the United States. So the individuals responsible were banned for entering the United States. Their visas were denied, and they were sanctioned and so on. So maybe that is a strategy that we should continue and uphold. Maybe the Trump administration ought to do that, but we'll see in time. Both countries exhibit strong forms of nationalism. Chinese nationalism under the banner of the Chinese Dream, and U.S. exceptionalism based on the idea of promoting democracy worldwide. How do these national ideologies shape their global strategies and relations with other countries?
I could answer that in writing. I haven't really thought about that.
Okay.
Wait, the question is how nationalism shapes.
It basically shapes their global strategies and relationship with each other. One advocates American exceptionalism, the idea of promoting democracy worldwide, and the Chinese dream of national rejuvenation, reunifying with Taiwan, gaining the territory it claims to in the South China Sea, and so on, and people living a luxurious life, increasing the quality of life of the Chinese people.
I mean, I could answer that in writing or something. I don't have an immediate answer on that.
Okay, no problem. How do you think the ideological differences between the United States and China affect their positions on trade, climate change, and global health?
Well, same. I'm not quite sure. Yeah.
Okay, no, I understand. I understand. What about looking ahead? How do you see the ideological divide between U.S. and China affecting their global influence over the next 20 years?
Well, at the moment, ideology is gaining ever more importance within the on the world stage, in the sense that there's
You. Yeah, sorry about that. What happens is after the video is complete, it takes time to convert before it can even go on Zoom. So I just sent a new link just in case. But I guess it worked out. Did you log in with the old link or the new link?
I started with the old one, and then I did the new link.
Okay, great, great. Where were we?
I don't know.
I think it had to do with the ideological differences between the United States and China, and what do
Right,
we
right. And what I was saying is that just in international diplomacy in general, at the moment, ideology is becoming more and more important because the United States is seeking ever closer relations and cooperation among democracies. And the group of China, Russia, Iran, North Korea are themselves forming, based in part on anti-democratic ideology, a loose grouping of their own. Now it's not clear. It's not as though the four countries are as closely aligned as, say, NATO or the EU or something, but they are cooperating at least into one-on-one with one another. So I would say ideology is getting more and more important now. I don't see, because foreign affairs is also based on all kinds of realist and balance and power, balance of power considerations. I can see the cooperation among democracies lasting and being more closely bonded than the relationships among China, Russia, Iran, North Korea.
Do you think that China is playing both sides, trying to develop a stronger relationship with the United States, while at the same time trying to balance against it with its alliance with Iran, with Russia, and with Iran, Russia, and North Korea?
It may be trying. I just don't think it is getting all that far, or even hopes to get all that far in a new relationship with the United States. I mean, take a look at just the last couple of years, the degree of hype that was built around the meeting between Xi Jinping and Joe Biden in San Francisco last year. I don't think either country believed that that was going to transform international, I mean, US-China relations, and it didn't.
Yeah, relations have been really there's been great tensions between the two nations, particularly during the Biden administration.
Right. But I mean, your question was about balancing. I'm not sure that the Chinese themselves think that they're balancing relations with Iran versus the United States. It's really those two countries and components are so different that I don't see that.
Given the strides that China has made in investment and research and development with the Made in China 2025 and other state-led development programs that it has initiated, how significant is it in terms of China's ambitions to lead in artificial intelligence, biotechnology, and clean energy?
I mean, it's significant. I should say that retrospectively, in a way, I'm glad that China announced its Made in 2025 program because it woke up companies and people interested in technology inside the United States and the West. They finally, it, somehow, they looked at that and finally grasped what China was trying to do.
They're trying to take the lead in those particular areas and channeling exorbitant amounts of money to reduce their reliance on the West, especially in light of the United States there's a lot of talk in the United States about implementing a policy of de-risking and decoupling. What are your thoughts on that?
I think the original word was decoupling, and there is some decoupling going on, obviously. I mean, you see companies moving from their some of their manufacturing to whether it's Vietnam or Southeast Asia or Mexico. But the very word made it sound as though all of American business was withdrawing from China and should. And I think that wasn't realistic. So starting with Ursula von der Leyen, I think in Europe, but also in the United States, the lesser word was de-risking. And there's a good logical basis for de-risking. I mean, we had gone through COVID and the threats to supply chains. So de-risking as a concept made more sense. I'm not sure, again, decoupling was happening, was never going too far. De-risking is going a little further. It's quite striking now that the common wisdom in Germany is that they became too reliant on China for exports and too reliant on cars and chemicals. So, I mean, the de-risking made more sense as a word and was more palatable in the West than decoupling. And it does make sense, but again, de-risking is not does not amount to pulling out of a country, pulling all trade out of a country and manufacturing.
Yeah, but it also will protect the United States from supplying the Chinese with critical technologies that can be, even though it may has a commercial purpose in their economy, but this military fusion, it can transfer over to its military dual use technologies, which can it can further challenge the United States, and it could also be used to unify Taiwan. What do you think in terms of Taiwan, what the United States' policy should be with reference with respect to Taiwan, considering Xi Jinping may as said that the PLA should be ready by 2027, the 100th anniversary of the PLA, to possibly reunify Taiwan with the mainland?
I think that American policies, I mean, over the years, but it's, well, let me take that back. American policy in recent years has generally been in the direction of a strong support for Taiwan, even if they've left the policy of strategic ambiguity theoretically in place. But generally, I think the policy has been strong support for Taiwan, and I think that will continue. I am a little bit nervous about the Trump administration.
Yeah, considering Taiwan produces more than 70% of chips to the world. I think 90% of the most sophisticated chips to the world. I think China is reliant on them for the majority of their chips as well. So that may deter them in some way, shape, or form, or they think they could take over the manufacturing facility that develops chips. Do you think the United States public would have the stomach or intervening in Taiwan should China attack?
That's a very good question. I think so, but I certainly worry about the general streak of isolationism within the United States. So far, it's been a minority view, but it's certainly affecting the war in Ukraine. Now, I should say in general that I look at the coverage at the moment of the n new Trump China team, and their China Hawks, China Hawks, China Hawks. What else is new? I mean, the Biden people were China Hawks too. What interests me, to come back to Taiwan, is that there are two strains of China Hawks, okay? And they're one of them. I would call the Asia First China Hawks. We should abandon Ukraine. We should, in general, give ever less importance to Europe and turn all of our attention to Asia, and in particular, to making sure there's no invasion of Taiwan. And then the other strain is what I would call the regular Hawks. I think that people like the new Secretary of State, who was originally essentially an anti-communist with of Cuban roots,
Rubio, right? Referring to
yeah,
Rubio.
Rubio. I think that those guys are not in favor of cozying up to Putin. So you get a funny debate with China at the center of whether the United States should abandon or withdraw its emphasis on Europe in order to focus on Taiwan, versus those, including people in Taiwan, who say nothing could be worse than to give China the signal that the United States would abandon Ukraine, because that suggests it might abandon Taiwan as well. And that's an intense under the surface debate with a new team.
Yeah, I mean, so do you think that if China were to attack, we would send our military there, or we would just supply them with weaponries to somehow counter, or defensive weapons to prevent Taiwan from being becoming a part of the mainland again?
No, I think we would support Taiwan militarily. The first, I mean, the military experts will tell you that there's a two-part strategy. First, the United States needs to give Taiwan enough weaponry to hold out on its own for several days, because that's how long it would take for American troops and planes and ships to get there. But then I think they would be there.
Okay. And do you see China as being on track to become the next superpower? What challenges might prevent China from achieving this status?
I'm sorry. Let me close the door here. I'll be
Okay.
right back because people walked in and are talking.
No problem.
Okay, I remember part of the question was, will China become the next superpower?
What
Right.
challenges might prevent China from achieving this status?
I mean, I do think that China at this point can qualify, given its economic position and status, can be considered a superpower at this point. I mean, if the Soviet Union was considered a superpower, yeah, China has fewer missiles, but generally, I think it qualifies as a superpower, and it's working on those missiles as we speak. What could prevent it would be one, a tremendous economic downturn, and two, tremendous internal disorder.
That makes sense. And what about the United States' role in preventing or containing China from right now its interests are to become a regional power, but it has or maybe it has aspirations to become a global power where it could influence the international community in a way that it's advantageous to its rise or to its strength. What can the United States do to contain them?
Well, I think the United States is already reacting to the possibility of a Chinese superpower. You find it in out of the way places like the South Pacific, where the Chinese are increasingly active. And lo and behold, in response, the United States is opening up embassies on small islands and things like that. So it's already doing that. I think that the United States should be much more active in Africa and Latin America than it is in pointing out the problems with China's approach. I phrase that in general, certainly the Belt and Road Initiative and the indebtedness that it fosters, the United States. And I say it should be doing it. Should be doing this. It is doing this to some extent, but it really needs to increase its efforts to prevent China from dominating what the experts call the information space.
But the interesting thing is if China is perceived as this great power and a superpower. It classifies itself as a developing country in the World Trade Organization, where it can avoid or where it can implement tariffs and other type things to protect its indigenous companies over the years until it develops into a great power. But it still sees itself as a developing country within that international organization.
Well, you phrase that as a matter of perception that it sees itself as a developing country. That the desire to have that perception is fueled by the economic interest that there are benefits, economic benefits that accrue, and you mentioned them, to being classified as a developing country. I'm not sure that China really sees itself as a developing country. I think it's kind of funny and maybe a little bit more subtle. It sees backwoods, rural, non-coastal China as a developing country. I think it generally it does see that, but I don't think that people in Shanghai or I mean pick your coastal city see themselves as a developing country at all. In fact, they take a look at their highways, even if they don't have any people or cars on them, and see them, or certainly their high speed rail, and see themselves as superior to the so-called developed countries.
Sure. It's technological innovations and advancements have really put it on the world stage, and it can compete globally with the United States in a lot of different areas. But so, to some extent, what they do is they seem to copy Western technology. They steal through hacking, through taking over American corporations or companies, among other things. But then they, through these state-led development, they work on developing it and advancing the technology that they've gotten from American co companies. Just like the high-speed rail from Japan, they formed the joint venture. Japan, they learned the technology from Japan and they improved upon it. That seems to be their strategy. What can the United States do to prevent China from doing that? Particularly in recent years, it has taken a lot of technology. Supposedly, there's a lot of articles on it's taking a lot of technology from Tesla, and now it's working on self-driving cars.
I think it should prevent the transfer of of any advanced high technology to China. Beyond that, I mean, it can't stop China from borrowing Japanese train technology and improving on it. I mean, I think there's nothing the United States can do about that, but it can certainly in very new areas of technology, whether it's AI or whatever, it can certainly prevent the transfer of skills, know-how, and technology to China.
Yeah, that's important. That's important, especially what advantages would the leader have in those critical technologies? What advantages would in terms of if they and if they develop technology that's superior to that of the United States, what role would that play, and how will things play out in the international community? Do you foresee if their technology is more advanced than the United States in critical sectors, in terms of computing, AI, biotechnology, clean energy?
I haven't thought that through. Certainly, it will present itself to the world then as the leader in technology, and we can provide things for you if we want that the United States can't. But I haven't really thought through what kind of role. But on the other hand, would it want to start providing these technologies to other countries? I think it's simply symbolically it would enable China to present itself as the world leader.
Yeah, and it can, instead of following the world standard, it can create the world standard for others to follow. And there can be a technology war between the United States and China in that respect. And
Well, there have been, and I don't know the exact details on this, but the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, which I served on for a couple of years, was looking at China's efforts to influence global standards and the agency that controls them.
All right, look, I mean, that's about all the questions that I have. I want to thank you for answering them. Have you been to China recently?
I haven't been, no, I have not. And I do not plan to go anytime in the next few years. If I could be, I would love to see China again. If I could be dropped from a helicopter into Shanghai, Beijing, or for that matter, rural China with a guarantee of extricating myself, I would be happy to do it. I'd love to see it, but under current circumstances, I'm not going to do it. No.
Yeah, I've written a book on the aviation industry in China, and I've got a lot of sensitive information. So I'm worried that if I'd even be allowed back in the country, or I'd be considered a spy or something like that under the current
Yeah,
state
that's the kind
theory.
of it sounds weird, but yeah, that you're exactly the kind of person that they would take an interest in. I mean,
So,
having written that book, I mean, yeah.
you as well.
When were you in China at any point along
Yeah, I
your
was
book?
back and forth throughout between 2002 to 2008. I was there back and coming back and forth. But after that, I haven't been there since Xi Jinping came into office. I think it's, to do research in that country would be virtually impossible, especially under the surveillance state, and listening devices. And I think people would be scared
Oh.
be interviewed or offer any information that can that may be perceived as going against the current regime or sensitive information, and they can get in trouble for it. So
Yeah.
doing research there would get me in trouble, if not the people I'm interviewing in trouble. So I don't think it would be beneficial to do research. I think most research has to be through your connections and networks that you have with people who have gone to and from China,
Yes.
and secondary information, what's reported in the news.
Yep. So I mean, you asked a couple questions I had no immediate formulated answer for. So I don't know whether you want to just drop them or
We
send
could
them to
drop there's I mean,
them.
I think in a roundabout way you've answered them.
Okay.
A lot of them you on follow-up questions. I think that you tackled it from some of the follow-up questions that I've asked.
Okay.
All
Well,
right.
good.
So how was your Thanksgiving? Was it good?
It
Did you
was
travel?
excellent. And yours?
Not bad. I was in Florida.
I was in New York.
Were you really?
Yeah, sure. My family. I have both of my kids live in New York, in the city, or one lives in the city and one lives in Westchester.
Oh, nice, nice.
Yeah.
I was in Florida visiting the folks, and my whole family's out there. So I'm out here in New York, New Jersey area.
You lived in New York for a while.
I did my PhD in Denver, so I was out in Denver for nearly 10 years. I lived in China for a while. I did some work in Albany, in New York, and then. Now I'm in New Jersey, working in New York,
Great.
and all over. And I really like Colorado. That's one of my favorite places to live. So maybe I'll go back there someday. Or if not, when I get older, maybe I'll enjoy the warm weather and move to Florida. How about you're in Johns Hopkins right now? Is that correct?
Yeah, although that's a little misleading. I mean, I write at home. Johns Hopkins actually, this is more than you need to know or want to know, but you will understand the academic dynamics. Johns Hopkins SAIS, School of Advanced International Studies, is in Washington. Obviously, the university is run out of Baltimore. And 2 or 3 years ago, the president in Baltimore was offered this great deal to buy what used to be the museum, but a big, glossy building on on Pennsylvania Avenue that has the Capitol within view. And he jumped at it because he could do this, show that Hopkins is at the seat of power, and it's totally out of the way. So I used to have it an office at the old building that was four blocks away from my home. And in addition, the old building was on what's called Think Tank Alley, which has Brookings and five others. And so now they're on imposing Pennsylvania Avenue. There's no housing for students. There's no interaction with other think tanks, but the president is getting his picture taken with the Capitol in the background and other donors and so on. So the short answer is I'm not at Hopkins as much as I used to be.
Gotcha. And just curious, what project are you working on now? What are you writing about?
Well, I'm thinking at the moment, I'm not sure. I've thought about doing a book that I would call The Deal of the Century about the W, just a history of not the impact of the world of China getting into the World Trade Organization. That's a good book, but it's been done. You know, people have written about their furniture factories in North Carolina and things like that. But simply how it happened and what, you know, the mistakes that were made that went into that deal. But it's a tough sell, you know, try and sell the New York publishing industry on a book that would have to have at least trade, much less WTO in the title. And there's not a great wide audience for that, much as all China hands are interested. So.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, I wanted to take this time out to thank you. I really appreciate you listening to some of the questions that I had that were just,
Oh, they're good
and
questions.
answering them.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you. I'll send you the transcript in English, and I hope if I have any future questions or in my writings, I can interview you again. Should I,
Sure, feel free. I mean, I've enjoyed
with
it.
your expertise.
If I see something that I said something that was I think was gloriously wildly wrong, can I in the transcript, should I let you know?
Yes,
Okay.
sure.
Okay, but basically, I think we're fine. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. All right, I don't want to keep you any longer. I'm sure you're very, very busy, and I want to thank you again. And I'll send you the transcript as soon as it becomes available.
Good. Thanks, Derek.
All right, have a good day.
Yep. Bye-bye.